Speaking of dangerous ideas, Jon Stewart recently announced that he's stepping down from his role as host of The Daily Show. It's kind of hard to imagine the upcoming political season without him. So let's take a little trip back in time to 2004. John Kerry is running against George W. Bush, and Steve Paulson calls Jon Stewart.
For starters, because we're on the phone and I can't see you, I have to ask you a basic question.
Yes, pink dress with a tiara. I'm assuming the question is, what are you wearing?
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, now that we have that out of the way, you have been, of course, following this presidential campaign very closely, and I think it's fair to say that the candidates have been trying to counteract various negative stereotypes for Kerry. He's said to be aloof and boring and unfocused.
Oh, I hadn't heard any of this.
Oh, of course, yeah. Have the debates so far changed these perceptions?
Absolutely. They've been freewheeling, spontaneous. I've been stunned at the sort of lack of caution that has been displayed in these debates. I mean, two men standing in the center of the ring, toe-to-toe, pouring out their hearts to the American people. It has been, wait a minute, these presidential debates?
These presidential debates.
Oh, yeah, no, those have been bad. I'm sorry. Thinking of Lincoln Douglas.
Of course, the main criticism of his presidency is that President Bush has botched the war on Iraq. Have the debates shed any light on this?
Yeah, I think botching a war, you know, that's got to be right up there with, you know, your health policy tends to favor the drug companies. You know, I think that's a pretty good, if you're trying to go for a criticism, that's a pretty sharp one to throw out there.
So how should we decide whether the war is going well or not? What are the criteria for success?
One of them is a lack of explosions, I've always found. And again, I am not a military historian or scientist, but I have always thought that one of the real telltale signs of a war being over is a lack of concussive action, a lack of shrapnel. And from what I can see, and again, this is coming from a fake news organization, but on the TV, it appears that there are very large, spontaneous, I perhaps call them combustion events, that tend to lean one in the direction that perhaps the mission may have been accomplished, and people are still perhaps celebrating with fireworks. I don't exactly know what's going on over there.
Now, one thing I've been wondering about, especially sort of trying to square a couple of things, you know, the values debate, the questions about taxes and all of that, is if you're a gay man who makes $500,000, who should you vote for?
Is this a rhetorical one again?
I leave that to you to judge.
All right.
Who should you vote for?
You're a gay man
who makes $500,000 a year.
Oh, that's an excellent question. You should vote for neither candidate, because neither candidate is particularly, I would think. Now, that I'm not sure what would go along with that. So you're suggesting that the Republicans are not as gay-friendly?
Perhaps.
Yeah. And that the Democrats are not as friendly to $500,000?
Perhaps, yes.
It's an excellent question. My guess is it really wouldn't matter. If you make $500,000, it really doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight. That buys a certain amount of privacy.
So if you have that much money, you basically don't even need to bother to vote.
Who's in the White House? And for the most part, for most people's lives that are doing well, who the president is not really the issue. The president truly matters to those on the, either the fringes or directly involved in policies that are more day-to-day, like the military, poor people, old people, people who love people, people who need people, I just got lost in something here. People. But in general, if you're making $500,000 a year, you know, Mr. T could be president and your life's still going to be pretty good.
Now, as far as I know, you yourself do not call yourself a Republican or a Democrat. What is your take on the two-party system?
I think it perfectly reflects the bichromatic prism that is human thought. As we know, human thought is really only possible in one of two ways. And so it, I think, is a perfect reflection of the simplicity and lack of, I don't want to say nuance, but lack of flexibility of human thought.
Bichromatic?
Yes. Black and white.
Ah, okay.
Or perhaps, to put another way, I'm glad that we have fewer choices politically than we have in soft drinks.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very enlightening.
That is the nicest thing anybody has said to me when I've been rambling in this manner. I thank you for not saying, by the way, why did you waste my half hour?
Thank you, and it sounds like you've got a show to put together.
We do indeed, and hopefully tonight it'll be a decent one.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Very cool. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That's John Stewart talking with Steve Paulson in a conversation from 2004. Stewart hasn't announced what he's going to do after he leaves The Daily Show later this year. What do you do when you're tired of making jokes about presidents? Well, how about writing jokes for presidents? Seriously, presidential joke writer? That's actually a thing. We know because Jim Fleming talked with the guy who used to write jokes for the Clinton White House. Mark Katz told him about helping Bill Clinton learn to embrace the art of self-deprecation.
In January of 1995, he gave a State of the Union address that was very long, hour and a half long. He looked over his shoulder. Even Al Gore was nodding off. But he was trying to do something. You know, this was just a few months after Newt Gingrich in the 105th Congress. He was basically trying to steal back his own agenda. So he'd put together such an ambitious speech that it went on for an hour and a half. And he was getting grief for that. And that felt like yet another missed opportunity in what was becoming, you know, a missed opportunity of a presidency. At that moment in time, he seemed like he was limping towards one term. So I, that very week, was the Alfalfa Club. He gave the State of the Union on Tuesday. The Alfalfa was Saturday night. By Wednesday, around noon, I came up with the idea that he should walk to the podium of this room where 300 of the most important people in Washington are sitting there waiting to hear from the president.
And not just 300 of the most important people, but 300 people he really didn't like.
That's right. Well, the Alfalfa Club is more corporate. It's actually not a press dinner. It's kind of a more of a corporate dinner. And he didn't have warm feelings for the constituents of that particular club. So he wasn't especially happy about going.
So he wasn't fired with a desire to make them laugh.
Or please them or win them over. And the idea that I had was he would walk to the podium, pull an egg timer from his pocket, set it to 5 minutes, and put it on the corner of the podium, which only set up, one, get that laugh, you know, a self-directed laugh, and two, set up a better joke to come, which is at the end of 5 minutes, keep on adding time to the timer for as many times as he wants. It was a big laugh each time, or so I imagined, except that in the half hour before he was about to give the speech, we were going to go over it for the very first time. And he walked into a holding room in the Capitol Hilton, and the first words he said to me that night was, "You can put that egg timer away." He was not happy with the premise of it, wasn't happy to concede what it conceded, didn't care for it one bit.
And he felt that long speech was a valuable speech, full of good ideas, and people shouldn't be making fun of it.
And by the way, he got a lot of applause in that speech. Why should that be held against him, you know? So, no, he didn't want to concede the point. And didn't want to do that joke. And it was a tense, angry meeting. Oddly angry for, you know, a humor writer in a room with him. And as I tried to kind of convince him of what had yet been self-evident to him, he walked out of the room. And I thought I wrote the last speech I was ever going to write for him. And I found the courage. I gave the egg timer to an advance aide and said, "The president's going to need this up on the podium." Even though I knew how strongly he had vetoed the idea. Because honestly, I didn't know what speech he was going to give. And figuring it was
without
my last
egg timer, half the jokes were gone.
It was the organizing principle of the speech. So as it turned out, he was up there rewriting the speech during most of the dinner and got up and gave the speech he wrote on the dais. And it didn't go over very well. It was meaner than it needed to be. It was less self-gracious, certainly not self-effacing. In fact, some people wondered if he knew the theme of the evening was humor at all. And as the speech went on, and as he could tell he was dying up there, and the red lights in his mind must have been flashing, he reached into his pocket and said, "Maybe this will help." And he pulled out an egg timer and got the one good laugh of the night. But the night was a disaster. It really was.
That was an argument, if there ever was one, for a presidential joke writer.
Okay, yes. I didn't put that in so many words, but I'm happy to hear you say it. I got back up to New York, and he admits, you know, that I felt, even in addition to the State of the Union address, to me, the Alfalfa dinner that night was the missed opportunity for him from the point of view of humor and kind of, you know, taking your medicine and really not just taking your medicine, but it actually there's a lot of tactical advantage in self-directed humor. And he missed an opportunity to be the biggest person in that room that night and really missed an opportunity for what I hoped would be a shining moment for him. But the shining moment came a little later in the week when I got a note, a handwritten note from him that said, "Dear Mark, thanks for your help with the alfalfa dinner. The egg timer was great. Best, Bill Clinton."
Mark Katz is the author of Clinton and Me, a real-life political comedy. He talked with Jim Fleming.